Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Tom Edwards, and ahead on the show, I'll be joined in the studio by John Mitchinson, co-founder of Unbound Publishers, and Anne Meadows, commissioning editor at Granter and Portobello Books. Plus, we'll head out of the studio to learn about the past 100 years of British advertising in a new exhibition here in London. We'll dial up our TV expert in Toronto to find out what we should be tuning into on the small screen this month. And later on, Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here to tell us what's at number one in Japan at the moment. That is all to come on the Monocle Arts Review, so do stay tuned. I'm joined first in the studio by John Mitchinson and Anne Meadows, and today we're talking books, of course. Now, you've each brought in two recent releases to discuss. Anne, let's begin with your first title, Lincoln in the Bardo, a novel by George Saunders. Now, I know this has been, well, a pretty big hit. It's certainly a big hit with you. Why do you love it so?
Oh, gosh, let me count the ways. I mean, John and I both brought in Lincoln in the Bardo because I think it's been so anticipated in publishing communities. This is George Saunders' first novel, but his 10th book, I think. He's written 9 short story collections, and he's incredibly well-esteemed. He's won a MacArthur Genius Grant. He won the Folio Prize for his last collection, the 10th of December, a few years ago, and among writers, he's kind of at the zenith of his profession. People adore him. Mm-hmm. And to be writing your first novel aged 59 with all of this anticipation must have been a slightly terrifying prospect. But Lincoln in the Bardo pulls it off. It's glorious. It's gorgeous. It returns you, I think, to the origins of why we read, that delight at being in a new world.
Tell us a bit more about the journey, I guess, that Saunders takes us on.
So it's 1862, and we're a year into the American Civil War, and Lincoln's son, Willie, is taken sick. And it's the night of a big party at the Lincoln's house, and the boy dies. And so the rest of the novel takes place in a graveyard in Georgetown in Washington, D.C., where Willie's body has been interred. But Willie is not the only person in the graveyard. There are also numerous ghosts. Men, mostly, who do not believe they're dead. They think that they are resting in their sick boxes, and they're in this kind of limbo, which is where the title Lincoln in the Bardo comes from. The Bardo is a Buddhist belief in this transition between states. So they're in this transition between states, and all of these ghosts can't let go of their former lives. So there's a character who is about to go home and consummate his marriage to his young and beautiful wife when he's struck on the back of the head by a falling beam and killed. So in the graveyard, he manifests as an apparition with a giant penis. And this giant penis is kind of its own character within the book. It represents various feelings that Hans Volman is having at any one time. And everyone in the graveyard, all of the ghosts, has a story of something that is missing that means they can't progress on to the afterlife. But the graveyard is also a very dangerous place for a child. So when his ghost arrives, it starts to be sort of tethered. And the novel becomes a quest for the other characters to try and save him from limbo.
And John, to go bore down in more detail into Saunders' kind of technique here, there's always that interesting question about a writer's command of, you know, original historical source material and this sort of thing, and how they weave their own own imprint into it. But presumably, I mean, from what you said already, you've been fairly unequivocal, but this is again done with the signature style you'd expect, the elan you'd expect.
So he takes, for the kind of the Lincoln bits, he takes lots of there are two kind of sort of dialogues going on. There's the dialogues of the sources, which are the sources that he picks between, telling the story of the party, the death of Willie, the internment. And he mixes those in with fictional voices. You know, I'm pretty sure that the guy who's looking after the cemetery that Lincoln visits is an invented voice. And then you have the voices of the dead, although, as Anna said, they refuse to accept that that's what they are. And these are done in alternating bits of dialogue. So William Volman and Roger Bevans III, who are the two main voices, interact, and they describe what they see. It's worth saying that this is fantastical. It's like a strange kind of late 19th century diorama or magic lantern show. There's an amazing bit where the people who've all been buried, particularly the black community, have all been buried together in a mass grave, invade the cemetery. Because what happens is when Willie arrives, his father, that incredibly moving scene, his father takes him out of his sick box or coffin and holds him. And this has never happened. This is this is something that's unprecedented. And suddenly the whole of the Bardo erupts and everybody wants to come and talk to the president. And without going into all the details, it's just, I think, an incredible bit of choreography. I mean, it has bits where it has the sort of humour of Beckett, but it also has the kind of homespun kind of, you know, Upton Sinclair, almost Garrison Keillor kind of people telling stories in wonderful sort of monologues about their own voice. And of course, there's a wonderful reverend who has figured out what has gone on and realizes that. But he's staying in the Bardo because he can't understand. He's lived a blameless life. Why he's been damned. It's highly fantastical. I mean, it's a weird thing. I mean, magical realism doesn't really quite describe what it is. It's too inventive and it does take you a while to get into the rhythm of it. But on one side, the history and the character of Lincoln in particular is, I think, as beautiful a portrait of anyone going through grief as I've ever read. But also the philosophical, the playful ideas of what does it mean when somebody dies? How do we let somebody go? Why should we let them go?
Religious and political ideas too. I mean, the afterlife that they are all avoiding seems to come from a kind of Judeo-Christian religion. But the presence of Abraham Lincoln in this graveyard inspires all of the ghosts, as John was saying, to kind of bond together and to become better than they maybe were in their actual lives. And I think in that way, it's quite a modern political novel as well as being a historical political novel.
Well, I think that just about sums it up. This book is required reading for all. Resist it if you can. Lincoln in the Bardo, a novel by George Saunders, is published by Bloomsbury. Acquire your copy immediately, I think, would be the takeaway. Let's move on. John, we'll come back to your first choice today. Dear Ijeowale, or A Feminist Manifesto in 15 Suggestions by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, the writer best known for her best-selling novel, Americana. Now, this book takes the form of a letter and is a... I'll try and summarise. A reply to a friend who wrote to her a few years ago asking her essentially how to raise her daughter as a feminist. Is that the idea here, John?
What sort of wisdom is
imparted?
It's such a simple idea. And she writes, she's a wonderful novelist, but it has that kind of perfect, like Screwtape Letters, C.S. Lewis's, you know, conversation between a devil and a person of faith. This is a letter to somebody giving them how to bring up your daughter to be a good feminist. And she doesn't beat around the bush. I'll give you the fourth of the 15 suggestions. Here is the fourth suggestion, which I think is great. Beware the danger of what I call feminism light. It is the idea of conditional female equality. Please reject this entirely. It is a hollow, appeasing, and bankrupt idea. Being a feminist is like being pregnant. You either are or you are not. You either believe in the full equality of men and women, or you do not. Feminism light uses analogies like, he is the head and you are the neck, or he is driving but you are in the front seat. More troubling is the idea in feminism light that men are naturally superior but should be expected to treat women well. No, no, no. There must be more than male benevolence as the basis for a woman's well-being. And so on. It's just full of really clear good sense. It's the kind of thing, a bit like, you know, if you're going to give Catlin Moran's How to Be a Woman, it's the sort of book you'd give to, I mean, I have my daughter is now 28, but I might even give it to her even though she's 28. It's brilliant. She writes beautifully. She's wise. She's got her own daughter. And there's plenty of nuance in there as well. Mm. But she's got a very, very strong and clear message to communicate. And in this week of International Women's Week, I think it's you know, good bit of publishing.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, Anne, it's International Women's Week. We have a massive, blatant misogynist in the White House, for example. This feels surely, you know, it's as timely as ever, no? The perfect addition to the roster.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that the more people who embrace the word feminism, the better. And the part you just read, it reminded me of Mary Wollstonecraft and the idea that she rejected that, you know, in Victorian society, people would say that the man was the head and the woman was the heart, which always confined women to the realm of feelings and meant that they couldn't act and they couldn't be strong and they couldn't lead. And I think there are people who will say, you know, that we have moved on to a place where we no longer need the kind of the groundwork laid in this way. But I was really shocked last week by the Polish MEP who came out and said that women were just not as smart as men, that they were not as smart and they were not as strong as their inferior, and said that repeatedly and repeatedly in the European Parliament. So I think he should have a copy of this book. I think everyone should have a copy of this book.
I think there is that kind of feeling. Chimamanda was interviewed at the weekend and saying that she's angry. You know, she's angry about racism, but she said she's even more angry about sexism. She said most people, at least publicly, refuse to endorse racism. But you still have a sort of inbuilt belief that somehow men and women are fundamentally different. And I think what this book is saying is if you allow that little crack, as it were, to enter, then that's exactly how you end up with sort of strange scenarios like the one this week of Emma Watson being kind of upbraided and then having to fight back. And suddenly you realise this agenda is nowhere near as clear, or the position of women is nowhere near as secure in our society as we assume it might be.
Exactly, and the battles still need to be fought.
She also, her fifth suggestion, which I think we can all agree on, is that is to teach your daughter to love books.
There you go.
And reading.
Therein lies salvation for us all, whatever creed, colour, sex or so on. That is Dear Ijeowale, or A Feminist Manifesto in 15 Suggestions by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. It's out this week. Anne, let's move on to your next choice. A memoir called Dear Friend from My Life, I Write to You in Your Life by the Chinese scientist and author. I think that's a fair description, Yi Yin Li. Tell us a little bit more about who she is and what she's reflecting on in this book.
Yi Yin Li is a writer who's fascinated me for a while. I came to her through her short story collection, which was published a few years ago and won a major short story prize, and she's since written novels. But she was born in China, and she spent the first 22 or so years of her life there, and her sister was one of the protesters, I think, at Tiananmen Square, and she fled to the US, more or less. She got a scientific visa to come and work in a lab there. And then she realized that actually she wanted to be a writer, so she gave up being a scientist and became a writer and chose to write entirely in English. So she abandoned her motherland, she abandoned her mother tongue, and in this memoir she talks about another type of abandonment or struggle, and that's the struggle or abandonment of her mother, who was an incredibly difficult woman by Li's account. You know, she would do things like take her 8-year-old daughter aside and say, "When I die, your father is going to remarry straight away," things like that, like these kind of small toxicities that Li has had to struggle with her whole life. So this memoir, it's about reading and it's about being a reader and it's about the consolation of being a reader, but it is also a book that was written in the wake of a hospitalization and a number of suicide attempts. So it's kind of about reckoning with the struggle of life and the brevity of it. And it's very powerful. It's one of those books I was underlining the whole way through. And I was underlining not necessarily because I had understood. I think actually she's quite an opaque writer in a lot of ways. You really have to concentrate and unpick. But I was underlining because I knew I would want to go back to all of these ideas.
And John, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, if we reflect more broadly, there is a fascination about writers writing about why they write or why they should write. And in the same way, books about readers and the joy of reading. I mean, I guess that's something that is endlessly fascinating.
Bibliomemoirs, which of which there are a lot. It seems to me that, I don't know, I think that and not having read the book, but I love the idea that having chosen the life of being a writer, but I mean, it's also the telling of the story and the intricacy and the seeing of patterns, which I think, you know, I'm always interested to read people who've trained as scientists, from Oliver Sacks onwards, to see, and crossing that line between being a kind of forensic examination of one's own life and being able to see the patterns and make, I mean, I think writing about writing is kind of inevitable. I've always liked that theory that, you know, the meaning of a poem is another poem. You know, you're always writing a novel in a way as an act of criticism or an act of love for other books that you have, that you've enjoyed. I mean, it's the Lincoln and the Bardo is a good example of that as well.
And then it's interesting, it's pretty obvious during the book that there's a connection to other books, which sort of is revealed. And I mean, do we get a sense of the role that played in the recovery? Because you mentioned, you know, this is quite a, I don't know if it's a tormented person, but someone who's faced some very grave challenges, you know, battling with things like depression, it's very hard. Do we sort of see that path through that?
Absolutely. I don't think Lee draws any conclusions, but she talks a great deal about a friendship with William Trevor, the author, and the consolation and the solace of that. And she talks about being an endless reader. She says that she reads to try and solve the problems of life, but all she finds when she reads is more books. So reading and being in dialogue with other writers is not necessarily a salvation, but it is definitely on the path of that. And I think it's interesting thinking as well about whether or not she's a tormented person. There's a line in the book which I think is my favourite line, which is, happiness and bleakness are not Orion and Scorpius, unable to occupy the same space in one's emotional sky, which I love because it's beautiful and very, very true. But I think that this is one of the bravest books I've read, but to me, in a way, it had an odd kinship with the Saunders because they are both writing. We have this very sort of brief space between life and death that they both evoke. And in it, we have to find joy and happiness, all the while being beset by difficulties and sufferings and losses. And Lee's response is one, and I think Saunders's response is the other, you know, to look closely and to pay attention or to kind of revel in the joys of life. But either way, there has to be some kind of reckoning.
Indeed. Pathways to Salvation. We're on a bit of a theme today. Dear Friend, From My Life, I Write to You in Your Life by Ian Lee is out now, published by Penguin. Let's move on to our final book of the day. Who knows? Further pathways may yet lure us. This is a novel called A Natural by Ross Raisin. It's the story of Tom Pearman, a 19-year-old footballer who's just started at a new club, is trying to deal with his sexuality as a young gay man in a sport where it's rarely accepted. Well, if ever, in fact. John, how did you find this book, first of all?
I've been wanting to read Ross Raisin for a while, and I was very attracted to the idea of his first novel, God's Own Country, because it's about a kind of a dysfunctional teenager from Yorkshire who loves the moors, and it was written first person and in a kind of lots of Yorkshire dialect in it, which is the sort of thing I like. And then his second book was another first person narrative called Waterline, about a Glaswegian, unemployed Glaswegian man who was failing to come to terms with the death of his wife. So this was his third novel, The Natural, and he's won a lot of awards. He was Sunday Times Writer of the Year. He was one of the best of young British novelists in the 2013 list. So he's somebody who I sort of felt would interested in. And I noticed this book being reviewed last week, and it was about football. And it suddenly struck me that actually there's very few novels written about football. David Peace's extraordinary book on Brian Clough being one of them. And yet it's such a big thing in our culture, and it's not the usual kind of thing that gets written about by literary novelists. So I'm not the world's biggest football fan, but I'm interested in sport and I'm interested in fiction. I have to say, it is a really, really remarkable novel. It's a very long novel. I think it's a novel that you have to stick with. It's basically the story of Tom Pearman. But it's also the story of there are basically two couples in the book. There's Tom and his becomes his lover, Liam Davey, who's the groundsman of the football club. Tom was a Premier League academy player, and he's ended up now playing what is essentially, it's League Two, the old fourth division, as we used to call it. So he's sort of fallen on slightly as his career isn't going according to plan. And he is battling, as you said earlier, with his sexuality. And then there is another player whose career is on the downward path, Chris Easter, and his young and quite unhappy wife, Leah. They have a complicated... So it's a third-person narrative. He's doing a very different... It's a very different kind of... You know, it's got a novel where he's inhabiting lots of voices. It's set in a place called Town in the south of England, and he captures English life brilliantly. The going, the drinking games, the sort of the humiliations. He captures, you know, the smell of the liniment and the kind of the players with their headphones on, kind of trying to calm themselves before the games. The unpleasantness of some of the coaches, the crap motivational sort of strategies of some of the others, the fat chairman, the constant. So that he delivers brilliantly the world. If you were going to criticize it, is that the kind of bleakness and the setup before you really start to get into the emotional crunch of the story is about 250 pages. So, you know, you have to really keep going. And there were times when if I hadn't been reviewing this book, I might have
skipped over one or two.
But he writes cleanly and beautifully, and in the end, the final, I'd say the final 50 pages of this novel are absolutely worth the ride. I mean, it's sort of haunting and beautiful, and he's taken something which I admire hugely, a familiar English set of characters that don't find themselves in literary fiction very often, and given them real depth. And done with huge humanity.
And that's interesting, isn't it? That point, actually, that John makes there about these areas that don't necessarily cross over one another, whether it's, you know, football in fiction or someone who's struggling to reconcile their gay identity with football and fiction. And that sort of centre point at the middle of that quite complex picture is an interesting space to be operating in.
Absolutely. And it gives me so much joy and delight. I haven't had a chance to read Russ Rosen's book yet, but I feel like we're living through an age where British novelists are trying to broaden their boundaries and trying to look at communities who maybe have been neglected on the page. And I'm sure John and I have read 105 novels about academics at universities and
surely not.
Yeah. Editors and all these things. So it's wonderful to have a footballer novel and a gay footballer novel. When you were speaking, it made me think of Sanjeev Sahota's book, The Year of the Runaways, which was also trying to sort of address immigrant communities in that case.
Which is another one. Really, the gay relationship is so beautifully and quite erotically presented. He really doesn't flinch from doing it. And as we say, the Venn diagram may be a slightly odd one. But that's the joy. I mean, you couldn't have a more different novel from the George Saunders, but it's that thing. This is what fiction can do. I mean, you can't imagine a movie ever being made of the Saunders. You could imagine
it. Sounds like a challenge. Fighting talk.
You could imagine it being made of it, but what you don't get is the interiority. You don't get that beautiful kind of your ability to inhabit somebody else's consciousness, which is what fiction alone really, I think, more than anything else does.
I feel like that's been a positive call to arms this week. A Natural by Ross Rosen is out now. It's published by Jonathan Cape. John and Anne, thank you both very much for talking us through some of this month's book releases. The advertising industry is worth over £20 billion to the UK economy, and as a way to celebrate the past century of British advertising, the Institute of Practitioners in Advertising has set up a space at the Old Truman Brewery in East London, showcasing the best and most controversial ads. These range from the 70s Smash Martians to the iconic Flat Eric Levi's ad and the violent Break the Cycle campaign by Bernardo's in 2008. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to the curator of the exhibition, Sam Haywood, about some of the ads that have in some ways shaped the world we live in today.
We were trying to make an exhibition that wasn't just for the industry, because they know all about advertising. This is about trying to get members of the public to come and see something about advertising that maybe they didn't know before now. So one of the things that we wanted to really bring across in the exhibition was just what a world advertising is. It's this kind of world of frantic creativity, research, deciding which channels out of the many channels that we could now, you know, push an ad through, how to get the message across to people. So the exhibition we arranged in a series of sets that look like different, completely different spaces to one another, and we wanted to create this kind of crazy juxtaposition between them to get people to even just subliminally go, gosh, you know, this is a really creative, active, vibrant kind of sector.
This first one that is just in front of us is the recreation of a very famous restaurant in Soho as well. Can you tell us a bit more about it?
So this is a recreation, in some parts anyway, of a restaurant that opened in Soho in 1959 called La Terrazza Trattoria. And it was the first Italian restaurant to open in Soho. And it kind of, aside from what it did for advertising and actually the creative world as a whole, it transformed eating in London. It was the first sort of cheapish trattoria to serve authentic Italian food, and it brought, as a result of that, it brought in droves of people who were looking for the new. You know, they were up for trying out completely different things, and as we know, London gets, you know, called the swinging London of the 60s and so on, and that was what this restaurant was a very like a foremost part of. So people who worked in Adland gravitated towards it, as did all sorts of artists, photographers, movie directors, actors, royalty, you know, Princess Margaret came here. So it became this kind of gathering place for these minds who were suddenly part of, you know, the many revolutions of the 60s.
Sandy, if you don't mind, if you could, we can walk a little bit, because there is an iconic ad as well that I want to discuss, the Levi's one. I mean, this ad was iconic, right?
Right. I think this ad was 1986. It is iconic, and we wanted to, you know, use the laundrette because it was one of those moments. I remember seeing this for the first time in the cinema and thinking, that was really very cool as an ad. And it wasn't really aimed at me. I was a bit old, too old for it by that. But the brand was Levi's 501s. They were a button fly, and they were quite expensive. And they were not trendy in the slightest at that stage, and they wanted to sell these jeans at that time for £20, which is a lot of money then. And the ad agency was sort of, you know, head in hands about it, thinking, well, this is difficult, no one wants to wear these jeans, and they've specified to us that the target audience is teens. I mean, how are we going to do that? So they eventually came up with this idea, you know, a laundrette where the guy walks in, takes his jeans off, puts them in the washing machine and turns it on, and then sits down, you know, very blasé, with no jeans on. And they thought that would be fun. But they also, I think the genius of it was when they decided that they needed to make it something that would really appeal to teens, who at that time were just grabbing onto MTV and, you know, the sort of the video, the pop video and the music. And they thought, okay, Levi's, let's go with it being a retro cool idea. These are old jeans. They've been made this way since the very beginning. So they've got that kind of vintage, you know, authentic character to them. Let's do a 50s style laundrette. Let's make this guy look like he's a bit 50s. So they gave him a sort of James Dean quiff. And let's add some music. MTV, that's all about music. Let's add music. So they add a version of Marvin Gaye's I Heard It Through the Grapevine. And those things that they just, suddenly it coalesces into this brilliant idea. And that's something that I love about all creativity. But in advertising, maybe it's more obvious to see because you have many people working on one ad altogether. So you, when people talk about how these ads were put together, you will get these, to me, golden nuggets of information about, well, and then suddenly somebody said, hey, let's put some music to this, and you think, oh yeah, and then wow, we've got this great ad now we've made a great ad.
And finally, Sen, let's talk also about, there's also more controversial ads. I mean, we're talking, yes, here more frivolous, cool, nice. Sure. But for example, one that comes to mind, the Bernardo's one, I believe from 2008.
Oh, yes.
That was quite a shock, I remember, yes, when it went on air. A lot of people complained,
yes,
as well.
It was a very upsetting ad. And it shows that, I mean, the one I've picked on is it shows a young girl who is trying to, I think the opening sequence is that she is fighting with another girl outside a newsagent's shop and, you know, gets into trouble for that, and she's locked up, and then she's released, and then she's sitting at the back of a classroom in school, and she can't read, you know, that is evident in the way that she's acting in the classroom. And then you get another sequence where she's sitting at home at the kitchen table and her dad comes in and calls her a useless cow and slaps her over the head. And the ad then chops, you know, it chops those sequences up one after another. And you get that sense of, okay, this is a cycle. And that ad campaign is called Break the Cycle.
20 quid.
So there were many complaints about that ad. And the ASA actually ruled for the ad and against the complaints. And one of the interesting things that, again, I learned as a result of doing this exhibition is that ASA say quite clearly that they will treat charities' ads differently to a commercial brand's ad. Charities are there for quite specific purposes. Many of them are, of course, controversial, difficult, sensitive, upsetting, violent issues. And if the ad can't put some of that across, then there's no point in charities advertising. Do you know? There's got to be a balance. That particular ad was only ever shown out after the watershed. You know, that we do have quite a regulated industry, in fact. But nevertheless, it's good that people were still able to complain and be heard.
That was Sam Haywood, curator of the IPA Festival of British Advertising. The exhibition is on until Sunday at the Old Truman Brewery in London. Fernando was putting the questions, and we'll have more from him in a moment. But now, what should we be watching this month? Whether it's Netflix or HBO, the Globe and Mail's TV critic in Toronto, John Doyle, knows where to find the good stuff. On the small screen, he gives us his recommendations for March.
March is a particularly good month in television for new and returning shows. There is plenty to savor. The way the television season seems to work these days is you get a rash of new shows arriving right at the beginning of the year, early January. Then there's a pause, and then the real sort of spring mid-season television kicks off in March. We already have the fifth and penultimate season of The Americans on FX.
You're going to get him killed.
I advise you to leave it alone. Nothing scares those two.
Everything scares those two.
This is a show about Russian spies in Washington in the 1970s. It's a show that has gained increasing acclaim and viewer attention in the last two seasons, and deservedly so. It's a powerful show about spying, about deception, and about politics, and it has a particular piquancy, I think, given the stories of Russian influence on the Trump White House. Coming almost immediately after, we have the second season of Love.
How long have you been talking to this girl?
She seems a bit complex.
But she is complex, you know? It's like every day, I think I start to understand her, but she does something that just like...
Watch this! Jesus Christ!
I don't know. I love it.
Judd Apatow's comedy, bittersweet comedy, I guess, on Netflix, which is about a young couple in typical Apatow fashion, a geeky young man and a beautiful young woman dealing with their relationship.
Everything okay?
Yeah, there was a fire.
On the farm?
No, on one of the lots where they had workers.
Did anyone get hurt?
Yeah, some people were killed.
Was it anyone we know?
I don't know, some workers.
A particularly good one to look forward to is American Crime on ABC. That's their anthology series, which deals with a specific kind of crime and uses that to explore issues, political, social, around it. This one is particularly fierce in that it deals with migrant workers in the United States, undocumented workers, and what happens to them. We also have, shortly after that, from Fox, a short-run series called Shots Fired.
What about Joe? Killed 2 weeks ago.
Your son's death was never investigated?
Can't talk about it. We both know something ain't right here.
Department of Justice, you see anything?
Talk to us. We can protect you.
No one's got answers for you, but you keep asking the wrong question.
Which, again, like American Crime, is very much anchored in social issues in the United States these days. Shooting in a small town, cops overreact. There are political implications for everything. It is particularly tense, this one, and well done. And then right at the end of March, we have on Netflix 13 Reasons Why, which is the adaptation of the best-selling novel about a teenage girl who commits suicide, leaves tapes behind which tell her real story and seem to implicate others. From what I've seen, it is particularly well done. It's dark, not as light as some teenage dramas can be, and it's a particularly good kind of binge-watching drama.
John Doyle, thank you so much for rattling through some of the things we've got to look forward to in March on the TV. I know that one that you're really looking forward to is a show called Feud, which is going to be showing on FX.
You got to keep them at each other's throats.
You have to.
Lose the shoulder pads.
I beg your pardon.
And cut back on the lipstick. You're playing a recluse who hasn't seen the sun for 20 years, for Christ's sake.
I might have something, but you didn't hear it from me.
Blind item, my specialty.
You are just trying to throw me.
I'm trying to help you. I don't want to end up a joke, Bob. You won't let me look ridiculous.
Of course not.
Pure, naked rancor. I love it. I want more.
Feuds are never about hate. Feuds are about pain.
And action.
Oh, God, I barely touched her. Jesus.
Did you get it?
Tell us a little bit about what this is about.
Well, Feud, in a nutshell, is about the battle between two famous big screen sirens against each other and against ageism in Hollywood. It's about the long-term feud between Joan Crawford and Bette Davis, which in Hollywood legend lasted for decades, and its roots were in the matter of a man that somebody was dating and somebody stole. That might not be quite true, as the feud actually reveals. It comes from Ryan Murphy, who is probably the most powerful person in American television these days. He's essentially being given total freedom, creative freedom, by the FX network. He had a major hand in the People versus O.J. Simpson. He is also in charge of the American Horror story franchise, which varies in quality from season to season, but is always compelling. In this instance, he's created another anthology series, and each one will be about a particular feud between two powerful people. In the case of this one, he's going back into old Hollywood, but it starts in 1961 when Joan Crawford, who is basically considered over the hill as an actress, as a former star, is looking to work again. And she comes across a pulp novel called Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. And on reading it, she is immediately attracted to the sort of gothic power of this story about two women. And she decides rather cunningly that in order to get the movie made, she will approach her arch nemesis, Bette Davis, to co-star in it. She approaches Davis, who at that time is doing sort of walk-on roles on Broadway and is also deeply dissatisfied with how her career has gone. And Bette Davis, being shrewd, recognizes the potential for this movie. But rather intricately and nicely done throughout the series, it goes back to the origins of the feud between these two stars, and we get the perspective of people like Olivia de Havilland, who witnessed much of what was happening in Hollywood in the decades earlier, Joan Blondell. So we get a perspective on why these two women really dislike each other and what an extraordinary event it is for them to be making a movie together.
Everyone loves a bit of drama about old Hollywood. How is it as a piece of period drama?
It is very nicely done. It looks gorgeous. The Hollywood of the late 1950s, early 60s is wonderfully brought to life in terms of colors, the cars, the architecture, the homes. It is done without being ostentatious. Scenes are beautifully framed to give you a sense of what these women were like at that period, their style, the clothes they wore, how they walked, how they performed. And it is done without it being, as you might get, say, in a major movie about this kind of topic. It's not overdone. There's a great subtlety to it. Ryan Murphy and his team have a great eye for being able to suggest this world without overdoing it and shoving it in the audience's face. And that also allows the remarkable cast, which is Jessica Lange as Joan Crawford and Susan Sarandon as Bette Davis, it allows them space to actually act and bring these two screen sirens, these two screen legends, to life.
And do you think this is going to be a major hit for FX?
I think it is, yes. I think it's a grabber from the get-go, to use cliched critic parlance. It sucks you into the story immediately. It moves fairly rapidly. It does look gorgeous, as I've meant. And these two very strong characters, played by two very strong actors, give you deftly a sense of the mental state of these women, and also the forces at play around them, which were at that point denying them a career And the two of them together, enemies though they are attempting to make a movie that will actually bring them back into the limelight. And of course, as scholars of film will know, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane did rather well. It is a minor classic of a movie. And indeed, the making of it, which takes up many episodes, is fascinating to see.
Well, I've seen the trailer and it certainly looks like it's been made with a great sense of humour as well, and it's going to be a very entertaining series. Looking ahead, I know that Ryan Murphy has decided that he's going to tackle a different duo with each season. Do we know who he's got in the pipeline next?
Yes, actually. And in Ryan Murphy's way, it is a pretty juicy one. For the second season of Feud, which he announced just as the first season is going out, it's going to be about Prince Charles and Princess Diana, which, given Murphy's sensibility and his gift for a kind of camp quality, which is rarely overdone, is rarely overripe, but he can bring a kind of acid camp quality to things. I think that is certainly something to look forward to as a feud to be savored next year or the year after.
Thanks very much to John Doyle, TV critic for The Globe and Mail in Toronto. To end the show, I'm joined in the studio by, as promised, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco for this week's Global Countdown. Fernando, where are we alighting today?
Well, we're going to Japan, a very interesting market on, and very different as well from the one I did last week, which was Sweden. It's interesting because, you know, first of all, the Japanese, they love Japanese artists. Mm. It's very, very difficult to find a known Japanese artist in their top 10. In fact, there's only one, and a very interesting one. It's Austin Mahone at number 8 with a song called Dirty Work. And you know why is it there?
Why is it, Fernando?
Because a Japanese comedian, his name is Bluzon Chiemi, he used in one of his performances, randomly, I believe. And then, you know, the Japanese said, oh, I like this track. So they started downloading because, you know, Austin Mahone from Texas is not that popular in the European or the American charts.
Indeed, there's always these surprises. And it's funny, you mentioned Sweden. We had plenty of British and American representation last week. Nothing, though, in the top 5 in Japan. So talk us through the, presumably, yeah, local favourites who are dominating the agenda.
Absolutely. We're going to hear the number one song in a bit. But let's start with number 5. You had Japanese conductor, he's 48 years old, Kenji Ozawa, with Ryondontai Neat Suite. It's a very, I mean, as I said, he's a conductor, so there's not so much, you know, it's more of an instrumental song. There are, of course, a little bit of dialogue in between, but it's a very, you know, quiet, sedated song, and he has a very long career in Japan. It's also quite nice to see, quite an unusual number 5 there. Number 4, one of my favorite songs, it's the band Perfume, Tokyo Girl. Basically, they're an electropop band since 2000 in Japan, and they're basically fantastic. And look at, they have songs like titled Chocolate Disco from 2013.
That sounds very Fernando, doesn't it?
If you would imagine this band, think of colorful balloons in the sky. You know, it's so bubblegum pop that you can't beat them. And they're still around with Tokyo Girl.
These are the kind of staples I always imagine are going to be featuring at the top of the Japanese hit parade. A bit of bubblegum pop. It's the thing we need. Is that lighting the rest of the way? Any other surprises? Where next?
Well, number 3 is a little bit more pop rock track by Lisa, Catch the Moment. And it's interesting because a lot of the tracks on the top 5, they're soundtracks for animes in Japan. And this one is the soundtrack of this new anime called Sword Art Online, the movie. I promise that's the name of the film.
Catchy it isn't, but presumably people are loving it.
Exactly. Number 2, talking about films, we have Jen Hoshino with Koi. This song was 10 weeks at number 1, so we are, you know, extremely successful. And also it's interesting about Jen, he's not only a singer, but he's also an actor.
Oh, I thought you were going to say he was a general, and that's what it was short for.
That would be super
it's
nice.
It's not a military man.
Shall we hear a clip of the number 1 song,
I think
Tom?
That's what we have to do next, Faye. Faye, that was so high energy. I gather there's 2 exclamation marks separately, just in the name of the artist.
Absolutely. It's called Hey, Say, Jump. And the track's called Over the Top. You know, every time
it was a little over the top.
It's the same effect after I drink a Red Bull, you know, because it's so energetic. And it's incredible.
Is there ever too much energy, Fernando, in both those departments.
I don't mind a little bit of energy.
Okay.
And can I tell you, I have a curiosity here. Do you know why they're called Heisei Jump?
I feel like you're going to tell me.
I will tell you because, you know, currently Japan is living the Heisei period, which, you know, is the date after the Emperor Hirohito died in 1989. So, you know, they are in a new era. So that's why they decided to call Heisei, because they all belong to this new era. Because basically they're all super young. They were all born after 1989, 8th of January 1989.
I feel like I'm aging. Just listening to that piece of information, I feel I've aged. Another decade.
We're both not from the Heisei period.
Comfortably, Fernando.
But it's a great song. Over the top, they've been around since 2007. Well done, Heisei Jump. Woohoo!
Well done indeed. Thank you, Fernando. That brings us to the end of today's programme. A special thanks to my guests, John Mitchison and Anne Meadows. And of course to Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who also ably assisted our producer, Holly Fisher. Join us at the same time again next week. But for now, well, we have to end this way, Fernando. Here's the rest of that number one track by Hey, Say, Jump. Thanks for tuning in. どんなに今を愛しく思って